And good afternoon. This is Angel Answers with Amy Toy. I'm your host, Amy Toy. And today we have a very awesome guest. His name is Rizwan Virk. He is the author of Zen Entrepreneurship, Walking the Path of the Career Warrior. And this book is very good. It's based on the experiences that guided him on the path of being a successful businessman and spiritual journey. And this is it's a fictionalized narration of his journey. And it's actually intertwines what your spiritual journey is with your career. So welcome, Rizwan. How are you today?
Thank you. I'm doing well. It's great to be here.
Thank you for appearing on the show. This book is very fascinating because I've got the newer one. It looks like it has been revised. I like the points at the end of the chapter. What led you to write the book?
Well, you know, I really wrote the book in reflecting upon my own experiences. When I was a fresh college grad out of MIT, I had started my very first company, and you know, the first half of the book is about the process of kind of breaking out on your own from a corporate job that I had had at the time, and the second half is about all the trials and tribulations that happened after I started my first company. And at the same time, I had started an apprenticeship with a series of spiritual teachers, and you know, very soon what I found was that these two areas of my life, which I thought were very separate, started to intertwine in ways that I hadn't imagined, ranging from things like, you know, learning to use my work as a form of meditation, to paying attention to clues from the hidden worlds. But probably the most important thing that I realized eventually was that our energetic patterns influence our careers, our jobs, our business, whether we want them to or not. So it's much better to be aware of how that influence is happening. And in my own case, as I grew my company, it hit a bit of a wall. And it turns out that the wall that my company was facing was very similar to the issues that I was dealing with in my personal growth and meditation. And so I like to say that I started meditating because I thought it would help me with my company. But really, in the end, I realized that starting a company or any career is part of a life path. All the challenges we face on that path are really to help us in our personal and spiritual development. So that's really why I wrote the book, was reflecting on that key lesson and all the other little lessons that I had learned along the way. I wanted to share those with others.
It's surprising because people come to me as a reader, too, and they'll say, oh, you know, my career path is separate from my spiritual path. And I have to agree with you. It's not, because you have – they're all lessons intertwined, you know. And you go on a personal journey, and – you were talking about let's go into a little bit about the first mentor. You like kind of put this guy into one. Is it Ramaswamy?
Ramaswamy is the character in the book.
Yeah. What was that like meeting him, and how did he was kind of like you said different mentors rolled into one. You want to explain that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So the book is, you know, as they say in Hollywood, it's based on a true story. But usually that means that you end up taking actual events, but oftentimes you have to rearrange them a little bit, or you have to combine characters in order to just make one coherent story. So the character Ramaswamy is an archetypal teacher, kind of like, I don't know if you've ever read the Carlos Castaneda books, you know, from the 70s, which were pretty famous. Where he had Don Juan was a Yaqui Indian sorcerer who became his mentor, and he became the student. Or, you know, more visually, we're all visual in this culture, you know, kind of like a Luke Skywalker with an Obi-Wan Kenobi or a Yoda. So there's an apprenticeship that happened, and in this case I've combined, you know, the character of Ramaswamy is based on one person, but really the teachings are based upon several of my spiritual mentors as well as my business advisors. And so in the book, you know, he's somebody who can teach about meditation, but also provide more practical advice in my own career, especially, you know, as I was looking to grow it. So, you know, perfect example of this that happens in the book is, I mentioned earlier, when my business hit a wall, my mentor pointed out to me that the thing that the company was struggling with was the same issue that had occurred to me before in my life, and it was that I like to jump into something. I like to work on it, you know, really intensely, and then I like to jump into something else and work on that really intensely, and then I like to jump into something else, leaving the first few things behind. And this had happened to me in high school, this had happened to me in college, and that was happening to me in my very first startup. And that was a direct reflection of my energetic pattern. It turns out the company built one product, which was successful, and then I started us on another product, and then I started us on another product, and I started a services group. We were just doing too many things. And so that was a, it was a case where there was a direct reflection of the inner and the outer, but it's sometimes hard to see that for yourself. And so it's helpful to have a mentor to point these things out to us. And really, the book is structured in that way. But really, the message of the book is that we can learn to clear our minds, and there is an inner mentor, there's an inner Ramaswami, if you will, who can guide us, who is constantly speaking to us by presenting us clues in the world around us.
That's interesting.
That's really what the book is about.
Yeah, that's, you know, and you're a very successful entrepreneur. You know, you have, you're on movie projects, you're a filmmaker, you did the international sensation Thrive, What on Earth Will It Take? Isn't it amazing that how you just kind of, I think you can put your spiritual life and your career life together. And that's a process, isn't it? I mean, you're very creative, but yet you're very logical. How did you intertwine the two?
Well, I think you hit on a really key point. And, you know, the book is about learning how to use your intuition in business. But really, it's about learning how to combine intuition and logic together. And that's, I think, a really important point because very much, you know, a lot of what I teach is, and what I was taught was, that we have to tailor our strategies that we follow in our lives or in our careers if we want to accomplish something. And we have to tailor them based upon the fact that each of us has a different energetic pattern. So if you're somebody who just jumps into things very quickly the first time you hear about them, well, then you may need to be a little more logical and step back a little bit and let balance your intuition and your tendency to jump in with logic. On the other hand, if you're the type of person that sits around and analyzes things and doesn't jump in fast enough and misses opportunities, then you have to do the opposite, right? You have to actually use your intuition more, both in terms of direction and timing. And so I learned to do the two by following, you know, what I talk about in the book, which is the seven clues that come to us. And the clues are little messages, what I like to call glitches in the matrix, right? They're constantly coming to us. And, you know, in the book I talk about using your work as a treasure hunt. And if I don't know if you've ever seen those old Indiana Jones films from the 80s, like Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Mm-hmm.
But in those films, there's always a spiritual treasure at the end, whether it's the Ark of the Covenant or it's the Holy Grail that they're seeking. But unfortunately, you know, there's a series of clues they have to follow before they can find that treasure. And again, unfortunately, the clues don't all come at once. You have to follow the first clue, and then you find the second clue, and that leads you somewhere else, and then you find the next clue, and that leads you somewhere else. And I believe, you know, the process of becoming who we were meant to be in this life, of intertwining our spiritual growth and the contribution that we're here to make, our work in life. I mean, it doesn't matter if you're an entrepreneur, or an author, or, you know, you do data entry, or you're an accountant, whatever contribution that you're here to make in this life, I believe that's the treasure we're all looking for. And so these clues help us find a direction and open up our intuition. So, I was trained as an engineer, so I wanted everything to be very logical, right?
Yeah.
A has to lead to B, and I wanted to see the causal relationship between it. But the most important kind of clue is what Jung called a synchronicity, the term that a lot of listeners are probably familiar with now. The basic idea is when you're thinking of something in your mind and something happens outside that relates to that, but you can't find a logical causal relationship between the two. And the simplest example is when you are thinking of someone and suddenly they email you or call you and you haven't thought about them in a while. Or, you know, in my case, I had a dream about someone the other day that I hadn't talked to in years. And so, you know, I used to be an entrepreneur and now I invest in and mentor other entrepreneurs and filmmakers. And so I had this dream about this person, and I said, okay, this is a clue. It's a message coming to me because it's a little unusual. I haven't thought about this person in years. So I contacted her, and she got back to me and said, oh, yeah, you know, I have this business plan that I've been working on. I've been meaning to send it to you. I really want your feedback, so I've been thinking about you. So that was the case where, you know, the message, the intention came through in the dream, what I call one of the seven types of clues. And so that's a great way to balance your intuition and logic is to learn to look for these clues and to follow these clues in our lives.
And isn't it amazing sometimes you get the same clue over and over again? At least I do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the important points of the clues is that if there's some repetition, you know, to those clues, then there's a good chance that it's something that you were meant to follow up on. And if you don't follow up on it, then you might get another clue. And I think this is a part of creating, you know, what I would call our own personal navigational system, our own GPS, if you will, right? which tells us how do we navigate based upon these clues. And it was getting back a little bit to what I talked about earlier. If you're the kind of person that follows things right away, you know, you may want to wait for some repetition to figure out which clues are more important than others. On the other hand, if you're somebody who ignores these things, they may just keep getting louder and louder. I'll give you a perfect example of another type of clue was what I call the errant phrase. And this is when a phrase jumps out at you and it's an answer to something you've been thinking about in your own mind. There was a friend of mine in Arizona a few years back, and she was looking to buy a house, and she had looked at tons of places, and she just couldn't find one that she liked or the right price. For whatever reason, nothing worked. And she was feeling a bit dejected because everybody else was buying real estate like crazy. This was like before the housing bubble burst in 2008. And she came to me, and she said that, you know, she was looking around, and she noticed a bumper sticker. And the bumper sticker had a phrase on there. It said, "Not all those who wander are lost." And she thought, huh, that's interesting. And then she ignored it. And then she was online somewhere. And then she saw the same phrase again, "Not all those who wander are lost." She said, "Oh, that's interesting." That's just two times. And then she saw it in another place. It was like three times she saw this phrase. And, you know, she asked me where it was from. And I said, "I think it's from The Lord of the Rings. It reminds me of a poem there that said, 'Not all that is gold glitters, and not all those who wander are lost.'" But of course, you know, she wasn't interested in fantasy and had never read it. But really, there was a message for her regarding her home search that it was okay for her to be not have bought a place, but to be renting and temporarily living in a place for a while. And she got comfortable with that. And then turns out a year or two later, she wanted to move out of Arizona. She didn't even want to live there anymore. And if she had bought a house with a mortgage and the housing bubble burst, she might not have been able to. So, you know, in the end, that clue repeated itself and was giving her a message that was part of a larger pattern.
Yeah, we have to listen. We have to see the signs, you know. And I have clients that call me, "I have a sign," and I'm like, "Pay attention to it." Okay. Pay attention to the bumper sticker. Pay attention to the license plate, because that's a clue on what you need to do next. Okay. You're a very successful entrepreneur, and you know you wanted to be one. But is this book primarily for entrepreneurs, or are these for other people in the, let's say, the career place, the 9-to-5 jobbers?
So the book is not just for entrepreneurs. In fact, it's really written, the subtitle is Walking the Path of the Career Warrior. So it's really for people on any career path. It's particularly useful if you're thinking of making a change, because the first part of the book kind of walks through the issue of finding clues and getting the timing right to try something new. And a lot of the book is about, you know, how do you reconcile your work with your spiritual growth. I mean, there was a quote from Sigmund Freud who once said that life consists mostly of work and love. And, you know, I thought about it, and really, if you add up all the hours, life consists mostly of work and sleep, right? You spend 8 hours sleep, and at least 8 hours at work for most people. Well, that's, you know, two-thirds of your day, and there's a little bit of time left over for love and everything else after that. So, you know, part of the path of the career warrior is learning to use these two major times of our lives, these hours that we often think of as being separate from who we really are and getting in touch with our spiritual selves, as part of the path. And in the book, one of the key practices I talk about is learning to use your work as meditation. And this is something that, you know, can apply really to anybody. And so as you think about meditation in the early days, it's usually about concentration, even though the end goal of meditation is not necessarily concentration. Eventually, it's about awareness of a larger part of us and a larger schema in the world. But initially, you pick something, whether it's an energy point in the body, it's an object, it's a mandala, like a picture that you're visualizing, a spiritual being, or maybe it's on your breath, or maybe it's a mantra. But you focus on this one thing, and what inevitably happens is that our mind will wander. It'll wander to the past. We'll think about, you know, what we should have said in that meeting yesterday in response to the guy, but we forgot to say it, and we wish we could have said something more witty, and it's going through our minds what we should have said, or, you know, what we're going to have for dinner tomorrow night, or the repairs you have to make on the house this weekend. So the mind naturally wanders, and then meditation initially is the process of bringing the mind back to the object at hand. Well, it turns out you can do this at work. I mean, at work, we may have a task. It may be, you know, entering numbers into a spreadsheet, or it may be writing up a summary, or it may be, you know, pushing some files out to the web. Well, whatever it is that we do in our careers or our lives. And what naturally happens is we get distracted, right? And this book, the story takes place in the 90s when email was relatively new. But now there's so many more distractions, and we have Facebook, Twitter, we have SMS messages, we have apps with push notifications popping up. And so there's always things that distract us in addition to the normal things that I already talked about, which is thinking about what we should have done yesterday or what we're about to do tomorrow. So the past and the future and all these electronic distractions are there. And so using your work as meditation is about picking a period of time and a task and then bringing your mind back to that task once it gets distracted, rather than following the Facebook thread or the tweet or whatever it is that's distracting you. And doing that is actually very similar to exercising the same muscle of attention that we use in early stage meditation. And it's really about learning to be able to focus and concentrate on whatever work it is that you're doing, but, you know, in addition to getting the work itself done. And I call that turning your work into a series of warrior's tasks. And a warrior's task is a task that has an obvious purpose and a hidden purpose. And a perfect example of this, I'll quote another 80s movie. You can see I grew up in the 80s. I don't know if you've ever seen The Karate Kid,
mm-hmm.
the original movie. But in that, the student, Daniel, had a teacher, Mr. Miyagi, who he was trying to learn karate from, and Mr. Miyagi gave him these chores of painting the fence and waxing the floor. And he got kind of upset after a while. He said, you're supposed to be teaching me karate, not doing chores. Right? But it turns out that the muscles that he was learning to use by instinctively painting the fence or waxing the floor were the same muscles he needed to use in karate, so he was able to block punches and kicks. So there was an obvious purpose to the chore, which was to get, you know, wax the floor or paint the fence. And then there was a non-obvious purpose, which was to train his muscles. And we can turn our work, whatever kind of work it is, into a series of warrior's tasks where there's an obvious purpose to get the spreadsheet done or write the memo or push out the website or whatever we're doing. And then there's a non-obvious or hidden purpose, which is to train our minds. And that's what using your work as meditation is all about. And that's why this really does apply to any career, really.
Yes, it does. And you mentioned that the goal of meditation is awareness. What is the awareness, of?
Well, you know, it's funny. I asked the same question of my teacher in the book. And his response is, that's for you to find out, right?
Thanks.
But really, the way that I like to think of it is that we are all, our minds and our bodies are kind of like those snow globes, where if you shake the globe, you know, the snowflakes are flying everywhere and you can't see anything.
Mm-hmm.
And when they settle, if you like leave the snow globe alone, all the snow will eventually settle and you can see very clearly what the scene is inside. And, you know, in my opinion, that's really what meditation and yoga are all about. They're actually about seeing more clearly, seeing our energetic patterns. You know, I talked about the pattern that I had where I was doing too many things at once, and it took, you know, some level of self-knowledge, and in this case, help from others to see it. But the clearer our minds are, the clearer we can see cause and effect. And so it's an awareness of our own energetic pattern. And when I talk about that term, you know, it's sort of the sum of our whole personality and our fears and our hopes and the way we instinctively react. I mean, some people would talk about the aura as the energy field, but it's really more about how we hold the aura and how the thoughts and emotions that we hold inside are kind of contorting it. If you go back to the yogic traditions, the mind and body are seen as a series of clear sheets or like clear bubbles, one inside the other. And initially, light comes in and goes out clearly. But what happens in the process of life is that we develop these what they called imperfections or samskaras in Sanskrit, which are like these little areas where it gets muddy and you can't let the light through. And as we go through life, we bend these clear sheets in different ways. And then eventually, all we have are the stories we're telling ourselves, and we're not honestly perceiving clearly the cause and effect. Now I'll give you another example in the world of work. Because of all the startups I've been involved in, I've interviewed a lot of people in hiring situations. And I remember, I think it was last year, I was interviewing this guy, and you know, he had jumped from job to job, and I asked him, well, why did you leave this job? And he said, well, I had a disagreement with the management. They didn't really know what they were doing. They didn't listen to me, so I left. And I thought, okay, that's possible. There's a lot of, you know, companies out there where people don't know what they're doing. So
exactly.
Then I said, okay, why did you leave the next job? And he said, well, you know, I disagreed about how they were marketing the product, and I thought they were idiots, and they didn't listen to me, so I left. I said, okay, that's true. And then I said, what about this next one? He goes, oh, well, you know, these guys thought they knew what they were doing, but I really knew better how to do it, and they didn't like my approach, so then I left.
So I thought, wow.
That's three times. Three times makes a pattern. But, you know, this guy was caught in this pattern, kind of like the movie Groundhog Day with Bill Murray, where he's living the same situation, but he wasn't aware of it. And he took no responsibility for himself. I mean, clearly, of course, there are people who don't know how to market their products right, and bad decisions are made, but once it happens three times in a row, you know, there's something about his internal energetic pattern that was influencing what was happening to him and his work. And if something happens three times, you know, then it's a pattern, an external pattern that is reflective of the inner pattern. So meditation and yoga, you know, allow us to kind of clear up these imperfections, kind of like wiping a muddy windshield, and hopefully allow us to see more clearly what's happening in our lives, and also to have more intuition to perceive the clues that are coming in from a higher part of ourselves to find the work that we were meant to do.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully that you know, that is a little bit better answer than you'll find out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or sometimes, as I took it, you know, if I knew it all, then I better start my own stuff. Maybe I should just start my own company, you know, or start something on my own.
Yep.
Be my own boss.
There you go. That's true.
Yeah, you know, it's the way I can relate to that guy when I was younger.
To fairness to him, he did have some level of awareness where he started to become a contractor rather than joining full time. So, but I just use that as an example, and so that's an example where he knew, you know, eventually he was able to recognize some part of the pattern, but he never really recognized it fully and saw how it was reflecting on his ability to work and his ability to be financially successful. Some of those companies he worked for went on to be sold for, you know, $100 million or more, and if he had just been able to work with people, he would have been a lot more financially successful as well. So it was interesting. It was an interesting story.
Yeah. When you're young, well, it depends.
When you're young, that's true. I mean, he wasn't that young, though, and had been in the workforce for quite a number of years, so that was why I found it an interesting example.
I worked, my past life, I worked, you know, I had my, you know, readings, my healings on the side, and then I was a paralegal, and, you know, I kept getting clues to get on my own, you know, and I didn't follow that for a while,
yeah.
And then I lost my job. I'm like, I better take this seriously, and I've been happy ever since, so.
Yeah,
I'm it.
There you go. So then eventually the clues came to you, right?
Yeah.
In a situation where you had to do that.
Yes.
I often tell people that, you know, breaking out on your own is an important part of a work path, but usually, you know, we have to find a sense of right timing, and sometimes I even call it a point of no choice, right? I mean, we can ignore the clues for a while, but then eventually something happens that leaves us with no choice, whether it's you lose a job or it's you've thought about this idea for so long that you're thinking about it day and night, and you're like, okay, I have to try it now, and you've done your homework on it, and so you're at the point where you're, like, very convinced it's ready to go. And that's that point of no choice is a great time to jump in, because the inner timing and the outer timing really have to match, I think.
And that's
an important part of the overall process.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And, you know, it's sometimes, let's go back to the intuition part of it, okay, for a second. And does your following your intuition always work? Has it been successful? And has ever really led you down the wrong path?
Well, yeah, that's a really good question. And I think this gets to a point where when we make a decision, you know, we have to learn to recognize whether it's our intuition calling to us or it's our internal pattern reasserting itself. And this is not easy to do, so it takes a little bit of reflection on our own process of making decisions, right? I mean, clearly, if an external pattern happens, there's a series of decisions that were made along the way. And sometimes we're acting unconsciously because it's our pattern. And other times, you know, we're acting more thoughtfully. And so it's really important to come up with our own system of signals. And another type of clue are our body signals. So, I mean, the short answer is, of course, intuition can lead you in the wrong direction. Sometimes it'll lead you to teach you a lesson. But other times, it's really just our pattern reasserting itself. So I'm now, not just an entrepreneur, I do a lot of investing. And, of course, I get lots of interesting ideas And anybody who's been an investor like in Silicon Valley will know that not every idea is going to work out or every company is going to work out. In fact, the majority of them fail. So, so now I have a process of both following my intuition and using some amount of logic to really find the right balance between the two. And I think that's what's important. So clues and intuition generally, I like to say, indicate direction. Right? But they don't always indicate the timing. And at other times, clues indicate timing. And so you have to learn to recognize when something is just pointing a direction, but it's not necessarily the right time to move forward. And usually the universe will help you if you, and it's like I was talking about earlier, where to find the Ark of the Covenant or the Holy Grail, they had to follow one clue, and that led to the next clue. And so the way to do it usually is to take a step in the direction of the clue and then wait and give yourself some bar or threshold before the next clue to come, before you jump in too much. And that can help, I think, balance the two. I was at Stanford Business School a few years ago, and we had a class on financial modeling where we built these elaborate spreadsheets. And at the end, they would spit out, option one is the best option. Option two is the second best option. Option three is not a good option because of the numbers. And, I remember, raising my hand, and I said to the professor who was teaching this class, and he had literally written the textbook we were using on decision modeling using Excel spreadsheets. And I said, well, what if you change that one number at the beginning? And he goes, well, then everything changes, right? All the options reverse in what's a good option and what's a bad option. I said, well, how do you know you have the right number? And he goes, well, you have to pretty much use your gut feeling and your experience on that, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's a perfect example of where the inputs, might be based on our intuition, and then logic is used to come to the right output. And I think finding that balance is not easy to do, but it's really at the core of treating life as a treasure hunt, is so that, if you're the type of person that gets excited by ideas, there's a bodily sensation that happens when you get excited. And you can learn to recognize that as a type of clue that says, oh, this is my old pattern, I'm about to jump into something new. And then you can take a deep breath using the stillness that you've learned in meditation or some spiritual practice and say, instead of jumping in today, I'm going to wait for a little while. I was on a radio show the other day, and a woman called in, and she said that it was her pattern she kept getting into these business relationships, and she wasn't able to get out of them when they didn't work out, and it happened a lot. They would always say the right things, but then things would go sour. And I said, well, there's probably a signal that you have, a body signal. Now, sometimes we hear somebody in a meeting saying all the right things, and we come out with like a clenched feeling, and we know something's wrong. That's one type of signal, kind of a negative signal. But my suspicion was, in her case, she had a positive signal, which was a certain rush about jumping into this new relationship. And I said, if you can recognize that signal, then you can take a deep breath and say, okay, let's wait a few days before we decide what to do. And when we get into the business contract, let's do it for a month first. And at the end of the month or 2 months or whatever the period is, we can decide whether we want to extend this for a year or longer. Mm-hmm. And that's a way of kind of using some knowledge of her patterns along with intuition as well as logic to make sure that it guides us to the right place. So I really think we need to marry the two together, and that's really a lot of what I teach people.
Mm-hmm. And can someone be truly happy and successful with their careers today?
Well, that's a good question as well. And I like to say that you can be both happy and financially successful if you can find the intersection of the three spheres. And usually what happens is that we're focused on one of these spheres or one of the other one. And when we do that, we're leaning one way or another. Maybe we're happy, but we're not financially successful, or we're financially successful, but we're not happy. And so these three spheres are, the first is, what we love to do and, something that lights us up. And the second sphere is, what are we naturally good at? And this one takes a little bit of honesty. For example, I may decide, I'm going to use an extreme example here. I may decide I want to become an NBA basketball player because I love playing basketball, right? But the truth of the matter is, I'm only 5'6", and I'm not really that athletic, and I'm actually a much better computer programmer than I am a basketball player, right? I mean, that's an extreme example, not that any of us are going to do that, but I think it illustrates the point that sometimes we set ourselves up for goals that aren't all that realistic, but usually when you're good at something, people are willing to pay you for it. And so that brings you to the third sphere, which is, what does the market need? And the market could be defined as jobs if you're looking for a full-time job, or it could be defined as big enterprises if you're looking to sell your services to these enterprises, or it could be defined as magazines if you're looking to be a writer, or it could be defined as film studios if you're looking to get funded for a film, right? So how you define that third sphere is very important, because the market is what eventually pays for services or products. And so if you want to be both happy and financially successful, you have to satisfy some sense of what that market is. And you can try defining it different ways. But if you only do that, then you'll get paid for stuff, but you may be very unhappy, right? So if you can find the intersection of what you love, what you're good at, and what the market needs, then you can be very successful, both in your career and as a business as well. I mean, some businesses, some startups are good at certain things. And again, being honest with ourselves, if you're good at working with people, right, but you decide, you know, you want to go and, you know, become a financial modeler, right, who sits and works with spreadsheets all the time, well, that's not really being true to your strengths. And each of us has strengths and weaknesses, and I talked about the energetic pattern a lot. In a negative sense, it gets us in trouble, but it also helps us. I mean, the reason I was able to break out on my own and be an entrepreneur at such a young age was because of my pattern, that I can jump into something new and really, you know, intensely work at it and be successful at it, at least initially, before I lost interest. And so I like to say that our patterns are like dragons. And there's a great Chinese proverb about dragons. It goes like this. It says, if you ignore the dragon, then it will eat you. If you try to confront the dragon directly, then it will defeat you. But if you learn to make friends with the dragon, you learn to ride the dragon, then you can take advantage of its might and its power. And that's really, you know, what this process of self-reflection is about. It's like understanding our own cycles, our own strengths, our own aptitudes, because people aren't interchangeable. Yet, if you can use that to find out what we're good at, what we like, make lists of each of those, what does the market need, and then try defining the market in different ways and find an intersection of those three, then I think we can be both happy and financially successful.
And speaking of that, what's your advice for manifesting abundance, you know, and the job and the relationship, what you really want?
Yeah, so, you know, there's been a lot, you know, said lately about the law of attraction, and, you know, a couple of years before that, there was The Secret, you know, and before that, there was creative visualization, and, you know, there's a long tradition of this going back to the 20s. When Andrew Carnegie commissioned Napoleon Hill to write Think and Grow Rich, and Florence Shin wrote The Game of Life. So there's a long tradition of how to manifest in the self-help world. But, you know, in the book, in the chapters on manifestation, I talk about, you know, my teacher teaching me that there are really four keys to manifestation, not just one. And what often happens is we focus on one of those keys. You know, those traditions that I talked about really tie to the first key of manifestation, which I call right intent. And that is setting your intent for the type of goal that you're trying to achieve, or whatever it is you're trying to manifest. So it's very much about holding an image in your mind, whether that means writing about it profusely and journaling so you can see it in detail, or meditating on that image, or asking a higher guidance for direction, or praying to God, whatever your particular way of doing, setting your intent is. But I think in doing that, we also have to be willing to listen a little bit as well. So as opposed to just pushing an image out to the universe and saying, okay, this is what I want, go get it for me, right? We have to, there's a give and take where we have to open our intuition a little bit and say, what images are coming back to me? And if you can find an image that matches what you're looking for and what is easy for you to hold in your mind, you know, then you've hit on something. You've hit on kind of a sweet spot where it's much easier to manifest than just something that you just say you want. I mean, for example, you know, you might say, I want to make a $100 million blockbuster film. Well, if you've never directed a film before, you know, that's a tough one, right? You can hold that image in your mind, but that really should be a direction that you want to go into. And that brings us to the second and third keys of manifestation. The second key is what I call right patterns, and that's what I talked about earlier. It's understanding your dragons. And if you're somebody who, you know, has been able to, you know, jump into something and stick with it for a period of time, or you're somebody who jumps in and loses interest after a couple of weeks, or you're somebody who, you know, is a morning person and can get tons of things done before going to work. Understanding that is very important in coming up with the right technique to get to where you want to go. I mean, it'd be nice if we could just ask and then it just showed up at our door, but you know, sometimes we ask and it doesn't happen right away. Ask and you shall receive. Well, sometimes we don't receive right away. And that, you know, is partly because of our patterns and partly because of where things are in terms of timing, but also because we may have chosen the wrong technique to go about it. And so picking the right technique is really important. I'll give you a great example. A few years back, I went to see a very famous author. I think she's a winner of the Pulitzer Prize or maybe the Nobel Prize for Literature, Isabel Allende, at Berkeley. And at the talk, somebody asked her, well, you know, how can I work on my first novel? And she said, well, here's the technique. Write a page a day and do that every day. And then at the end of the year, you'll have enough material for a novel, and then spend the next 6 months every day revising that, and you'll have your first novel. And I remember thinking, ooh, that sounds like a great technique. And, you know, she's obviously very successful, world-renowned author. I should go back and try that technique. And I tried it, and it didn't work for me. Turns out that was the wrong technique for my energetic pattern. Well, it might have been the right technique for her. So I could write 5 pages a day and then not write anything for a few days and then write 10 pages, but I could just not bring myself to write a page a day. And so the slow and steady approach wasn't the right approach for me as a writer, even though it might be for some other people. And so that's where choosing the right technique, and oftentimes there's almost too many techniques out there. If you want to make, you know, be a successful investor in real estate or the stock market, or, you know, you want to get into the film business, or you want to get in the video game industry, or you want to get into TV or radio, you know, there are almost lots of books out there about how to get there. But sometimes the problem is not that. The problem is choosing the right technique that works with our energetic pattern, as opposed to the techniques that will work with somebody else's energetic pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, that brings me to the fourth key of manifestation, which in some ways is the most important, and I mentioned it earlier, and it's really right timing or appropriateness. Like, what is an appropriate goal for us to be able to manifest at this point in time? And sometimes there's a larger pattern in our lives that we're not aware of, and that's why I tell people to follow the clues, because the clues are hints or signs of this larger pattern. But that pattern may not emerge until years later. And so we have to learn to be patient and recognize the divine timing. I'll use a great example of a famous story of Steve Jobs. When he was younger and in college, at one point he dropped all his classes and walked roamed around campus looking for something to do. And he saw this sign, a poster, for a calligraphy class. And so he decided to take the calligraphy class instead of all the classes he should have been taking. Now, that doesn't seem like a logical thing to do for somebody who's going to be a future founder of Apple Computer, right?
Mm-hmm.
But turns out, years later, when he had started Apple Computer, and they were working on the first Macintosh computer, it was because of that class, and he said this many times, that he fell in love with fonts and font faces and different sizes and variable fonts, that he insisted that the Mac have all these different fonts as opposed to just a simple courier font, you know, shipping out of the box. And so who knows, if he hadn't taken that class years earlier, you know, we could still be working on green screens with courier fonts rather than the rich World Wide Web as we know it today. Now, that's kind of an extreme example, but that's a case where one thread for following your intuition, you know, led to something further down the road. I'll give another example, which is in my own life and in my book. So I actually wrote the first edition of this book quite a few years ago, back in 2004. And I kept getting these signals and intuition that, okay, get the book out there. But every time I tried, some obstacle would appear. You know, I'd get an agent, and then the agent would disappear. I'd find a publisher, and then something would happen. And it felt like I was going uphill. And that's a perfect example when I think clues indicate direction, but the timing is something else. And so eventually, you know, because it started to feel like it was going uphill, the timing personally wasn't right. I was so busy with my own startup at the time. And the timing in the market was wrong. We were in the middle of the Iraq War, and a lot of people weren't very concerned with finding meaningful work, right? It was a whole different kind of ethos out there. And so eventually I had to pull back and said, okay, let me just concentrate on doing my own business stuff for now. And then last year, in 2012, which is quite a few years later, I started to get the signals that now is the right time for this book to really get out there. And at first I ignored them, but they kept getting louder. I started to get clues. And so then I said, okay, well, what is the book missing? And I got feedback from a lot of people who had read the first edition that you needed some summaries and how-tos and exercises so that people could apply these principles in their own lives. So eventually I gave in and I wrote those. And now, you know, the market is very different. Today people are very much concerned with, you know, what type of work are they doing? Is it meaningful work? Is it fulfilling to them? And increasingly people are looking for you know, some combination of the spiritual and practical. And then, you know, I was very different. You know, not only had I started many more companies, but I had sold them and I had mentored many people. So I had seen patterns at work across a much broader set of people, and I knew a lot of more about consumer marketing. So the inner timing was very different, and the outer timing was very different. And it seemed to have coincided quite well when I released the book just a month or two ago. In June, it became an international bestseller in like 5 countries. And, you know, this was maybe almost 10 years after I originally wrote it. So sometimes there's a bigger plan at work, and we have to be able to ride the waves of the timing and take what's appropriate at a given point in time. And hold on to it, but allow the universe to proceed at its own pace. So I think that's an important part of manifestation as well, that people often ignore, because usually we want it and we want it now, right?
That's right.
What we usually say.
Yeah, we want. Yes, we're instant gratification, and we can't. It's funny you mention about a book, because I've been writing my my memoirs and everything off and on for the past couple of years, and it's just like I push it off, and then I get busy, and yeah, so it's divine timing. Definitely.
Yeah, especially in the writing process itself, right? I mean, it may take several years to get it just right. I mean, I actually wrote this book over a course of 5 years initially, but really it was 6 months intensely, and then nothing for a year, and then another 6 months, and then nothing for a year, and then another 6 months. So it really, which fit my energetic pattern quite well, as I would, you know, I can work very intensely on things at times, and then at other times I need to work on something else.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same way. That's interesting you mentioned that. You know, and I like the subtitle, Walking the Path of the Career Warrior. How can someone become a career warrior?
Well, you know, I view becoming a career warrior, and the book talks about the 14 principles of becoming a career warrior, and I won't go through them all here, but we have talked about, you know, several of them already, which is, you know, one, learning to clear your mind so that you can open up your intuition to look for clues. Another is to be able to use your work as a form of meditation or spiritual growth so that you can turn your work into a series of warrior's tasks. There's an old quote from Carlos Castaneda, who I mentioned earlier from one of his books that I really liked, which said that an ordinary person sees everything as a blessing or a curse, but a warrior sees everything as a challenge. And I think that's an important part of taking up the perspective of becoming a career warrior. And we use the term warrior here not so much in the external sense of violence, et cetera, but really in the internal struggle that we each have with our own inner demons and our own inner dragons. And it's fighting against those tendencies to really be able to get knowledge of what's happening. You know, the book talk is bringing together traditions, Eastern traditions of meditation and Zen, with some Native American traditions of paying attention to the dream world. It's another type of clue that we can talk more about, with making choices and understanding our patterns in the world of work. And so being a career warrior really is learning to fuse these things together as one integrated path. And you know, there's a great quote from the psychologist Carl Jung, where he said that the goal of psychology shouldn't be just to help people with their mental disorders. Really, it should help them in becoming the person they were meant to be. And that's really the treasure at the end. You ask, what will you find in meditation? Well, another question is, what will you find at the end of these clues? And that is the treasure. It's finding the person that you were meant to be and walking your own unique warrior's path, as I call it in the book. And I define that as a combination of the lessons that we're here to learn, which is the work we're here to do on ourselves, which is this inner struggle that I talked about. So the combination of the inner struggle with the contribution that we're here to make to the world. And that, you know, could come in many different forms. It could come in the forms of putting out some knowledge, could be in writing, could be just in the work that we do every day in contributing to the companies that we're part of or our families. Whatever that contribution is, it ties very much to our strengths and our weaknesses, to the pattern. And so, you know, if you're able to be conscious of those two, then you're really walking the path of the career warrior.
Mm-hmm. And let's touch on briefly about dreams. How are they an important part of our career successes?
Sure. So I mentioned earlier about, you know, if you add up all the hours, right, that mm-hmm. life consists mostly of work and sleep. And we talked a little bit about using your work as meditation. But using your sleep as a form of spiritual growth and meditation is also really interesting concept, and it's one that goes way back. I mean, dreams are very complicated subjects, and I think I read somewhere once that dreaming, you know, is as complicated as life. Right? And life is pretty complicated. You can't just talk about life, you know, in one sentence or even one book, because there's so many different aspects to life. Similarly, there are so many different aspects of dreaming. I think more books have been written about dreams than any other subject in human history. You know, going back to the time of the Greeks or further. And the reason is everybody dreams, right? So it's such an essential part of life. In a lot of the Native American traditions, you know, they divide up dreams into little dreams and big dreams. And big dreams are a form of shamanic initiation. It's when we are called to do something by the spirit world. Now, if you look at the Tibetan traditions, they also talk about big dreams and little dreams. They use different language. They use the language of ordinary karmic trace dreams, which are a lot of dreams where we're just regurgitating what we've seen during the day, and our dreams are kind of creating situations to let that psychic energy out. So those are considered, you know, ordinary karmic trace dreams. Now, in Western psychology, those might be dreams we interpret, but in a lot of tradition, in Tibetan traditions, they might ignore those and look for dreams of clarity, the big dreams. And these are dreams that actually come with a message or an energy from the spiritual world. And so, you know, we spend so much of our time at work that, you know, how frazzled our minds are at the end of the day before we go to sleep will affect our dream state. And we can remember our dreams by writing them down or by building our dream muscles. And let me be a little more practical here. I think we can look for certain symbols in our dreams that we will learn to recognize as pertaining to our work. And I'll give you a great example. Years ago, I was we started a new company, and this was after the dot-com bubble burst in 2000, 2001, and I was trying to figure out what we should do next, and I ended up in a dream state in this generic business conference. And that was my clue. So, you know, I had had dreams before, and I relate some of them in the book, where I was at a generic business conference. And that's like a setting in my dreams that says, hey, this is related to your work. There's something important here. Pay attention. And I think we all have these kinds of symbols that are telling us that a certain dream is very important. And in this case, I ended up walking up to people that I had worked with in the 90s, and there were a bunch of them gathered around a group looking at something. And I said, you know, what are you working on? And he said this one technology. And I turned to the next guy and said, what are you working on? And he said the same technology. And the third guy and the fourth guy and the fifth guy, and they all said the same technology. And then one of them handed me a brochure that they were all looking at. And it was of a product that looked like a spider. It had, like, this technology in the middle, and it had links out to all these different enterprise systems and document formats and things. And I said, huh, that's kind of interesting. Then I woke up, and I said, oh, that's very interesting. You know, here's a potential product for us to build. And I said, I'm not going to listen to that. That came in a dream. So we did something else. But a year later, when that something else didn't work, we ended up going back and building pretty much that exact product that I had seen, you know, in my dreams. And that dream was very memorable to me because it gave me specific information, but also it was the feeling of the dream. And so when we have dreams that are extremely vivid, that we can remember without even writing them down. I'm not necessarily talking about nightmares here, but dreams that come with a feeling of there's a message here that we can bring, and an energy here to bring into the world. Then we've put our dreams to use, and that's really what dreaming is about, putting ordinary dreams and our sleep time to work, because we're much more in touch with our intuition. We're much more in touch with the spiritual side of life, what I call the hidden worlds. We're more in touch with angels and other beings that might be on the other side in our dreams because our conscious guard is down. And so it's a matter of learning to bring the waking world and the dreaming world closer together. They're already interrelated, but because when you go into one, you kind of forget about the other. It's about trying to take our consciousness to a level where we can remember our waking life when we're in the dream and remember our dreaming life when we're awake. That gives us a much more powerful ability to follow clues and use our intuition in the world around us. So that's really what using your dreams as part of a career warrior is all about.
Yeah, the book is fascinating. We got to wrap this up in a few minutes. But the book is very fascinating. You mentioned about the ending of chapters, the summation. I found that helpful for me personally. I read the chapter, and I like the summation with the different points in it. So if anyone wants to get the book, it's an awesome book. Any final thoughts?
Well, you know, someone once asked the Buddha and said, what is the path to happiness? And he answered, you know, there is no path to happiness. Happiness is the path. And that's an aspect of kind of learning to be present that is also very important in our lives, that we can be happy doing whatever we're doing now in the moment if we learn to tune into the moment and the spiritual energy that's always with us.
Mm-hmm. That is very true. Living in the present moment is very important, especially when you are, you know, people are always looking for the next best thing. And sometimes you just need to stay in the moment. And,
that's right.
Yeah,
and when you do, coincidentally, you know, then you start to get the messages about what's next much more clearly.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
It's a paradox in a way, right? Rather than looking too hard, by being present, we can learn to listen and see what's coming up. You know,
exactly.
By clearing the muddy windshield, if you will.
Exactly. And the soul unfolds at each and every moment, you know, like our intuition. So, well, the book is called Zen Entrepreneurship, Walking the Path of the Career Warrior. Rizwan Virk is the author, and it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on the show today out of your busy schedule and enlightening us with a book that I think is going to be in my reference library for a long time.
Great. Well, thank you for having me, and I'm glad to be here. I really enjoyed it.
Me too. Thank you very much. And everyone, next week, Nick Redfern will be on the show. Everyone, take care. Thank you.